Welcome to episode 24 of season 11 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we currently our way through the 2001 award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Patty Flint, an international man of mystery. Welcome back to the show, Patty. It's been a while.
It has. It's been a good long while. I think Die Hard, wasn't it, Rob?
I believe so. That was season three. So mm-hmm. you've been AWOL for was it seven or eight seasons?
You know, I have been paying attention as best as possible.
Okay,
wait in the wings for my chance again, and here we are.
There you go. And I found something that is dear to your heart, even though there are no dogs in the episodes that we're going to be doing today, tomorrow, and Monday.
This is true.
I didn't notice any. Maybe you noticed some in the back. Maybe there was some barking. You know, I'm not as much of a fan of dogs as you are. So you never know. It's possible that you might have noticed something that I just, you know, on purpose ignored. Who knows?
You know, who knows?
Who knows? Who knows? All right. So why don't you first start by telling me and everyone else, what is your history with Band of Brothers?
Oh, wow. Band of Brothers, I remember when it first came out. I still have the original box set, which I repeat and replay frequently throughout my days. I'm big into my World War II history, and I'm ex-military, so all of those sort of tick the boxes for me. I also really love the character development, as you see not only the war, but the series go on, and how they respond to all the different trials and tribulations they have to face.
Yeah, that's true. How many times do you think you've seen this?
Cool.
I can't tell you how many times I've seen it. I've seen it probably, I would say I've probably seen it about 15 times. That would be my guess. Yeah. But I never really kept track of it. So
I would say at least that for me, because I also had, I may or may not have had a copy on a hard drive when I was off in the military. So I would tour around and I did the Falklands for months at a time and things. And I had a very limited hard drive, and on that was Band of Brothers pretty much all the way through. And we watched that almost continuously. So okay. It was, there must have been a good 20 or 30 times, I think.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you see, you're even more of an expert on this than I am.
No, I wouldn't say that.
Why not? You can. It's possible. I don't claim, you know, I'm not claiming to be the end-all, be-all expert on Band of Brothers. I mean, again, that's why I have guests. That's why I've been doing interviews with people who are connected to the show, the book, the men, and all that stuff. So, you know, those are people that know more than I do. I mean, like, George Luz Jr. knows more about the men than I do, for sure. You know, there's no question about that. I wouldn't even go anywhere near that. And, you know, I'm going to have a few interviews coming up over the next few months with people behind the scenes of the show, of the miniseries itself, and also some of the actors and things like that. Obviously, those people know a hell of a lot more than I do. They have not done what I'm doing here by, you know, dissecting this miniseries 5 minutes at a time. That they haven't done. Mm. I think I have the monopoly on Band of Brothers for that. I believe so. You know, I could be wrong.
I would say so. Yeah.
If anyone knows anything different, let me know. You know, I'm fine with that. Again, I'd love to meet someone who actually has trumped me on that and has the monopoly, because, you know, I'd love to talk to them about it, you know, to pick their brain about things. So
absolutely. Yeah. And if they're better than Rob, then don't tell us.
No, I want to hear. That's fine. You know, I've listened to podcasts that talk about Band of Brothers, you know, so it's, you know, I don't have a problem with that. You know, this is
cool.
This is a learning experience, and I want to continue to learn more about them, about the story and the men and stuff like that. So anyone who can enlighten me more on what's going on here, that's more than welcome. You know, I don't have a problem for one second about that.
Fair one, fair one.
Yeah. Okay, so episode 24 begins with Buck continuing to fire and ends with Buck and Malarkey reaching the third battery. So we ended things yesterday with them beginning the assault. I mean, we've been dealing with the assault the last few days, and at this point, you know, we get to see Buck in action again, and he screams, "Winters, 1 o'clock!" And he, you know, pulls a pin of a grenade and gets ready to throw it, and misplaces it, and that grenade falls on the ground. And he screams, "Grenade!" And everyone quickly jumps out of the trench that they're in. You know, you have a bunch of the guys that are all around there, and they're all. For me, I believe that they take a little too much time to try and get out of there. I think that grenade should have gone off beforehand.
Yeah,
that would be my guess, because it is a good 5 or 6 seconds before they even get out of the trench. And then
I was very quick to write down cook-off time, the cook-off time of a grenade, and it seemed to vary quite a lot through this episode or through this minute or short interlude. I've currently got the video up frozen with grenade in mid hang time and the look of desperation there from Buck, sort of thinking this is just gone really horribly wrong. And how do we sort this out?
Exactly.
But he does have a bit of a flap at it. And then, fair play to him, he does shout out the trench, "Get out."
Understandable. You know, he wants to, you know, he fumbles it. It's really funny. I mean, we talked about this the other day, that, you know, Buck was both a baseball and football player in college.
Yes, he was, you know, UCLA.
So,
yeah,
that's right. And so for him to fumble the grenade is quite funny. I mean, again, we saw how perfect he was able to throw the grenade and hit a guy square in the head. And you know, the book talks about that really did happen.
Yeah,
you know, that's not just poetic license of what they use here. You know, it's something that really did happen for with him. At least according to the book.
Yeah. And I believe he was obviously hit as he went, as someone else ran past him in the trench. So it looks like possibly Lee Gar, somebody that was with that group, hit him as he was going to throw, which is where the fumble came in. The other hilarious one is just afterwards when Winters is, he obviously looks around him to see what's going on and then realizes, "I'm out of the trench." Now, that's a really bad place to be. So
yeah,
it just had it's almost a comedic look of, uh-oh, and then straight back in the trench again.
And then he goes back in the trench, and we see Toy is still on the ground, you know, covered in dirt and everything like that. And Toy is just not happy. This is already the second time.
Absolutely, because this is another thing that happened in the battle, and I believe when the first one was a potato masher, and then the next one was one of their own grenades.
That's right, and he screams Joe, and Joe goes, "Jesus Christ, twice." that is pure luck. The fact that or divine intervention. The fact that Boyd did not get killed in either of those grenade attacks. I mean, again, we will find out in a few months from now what actually does happen to Toy. You know, he unfortunately doesn't get away unscathed. But
no,
you know, but Kirk Acevedo does a great job.
So good this
character.
He has that simple ruggedness. But also in a he's a kind of deadpan in some ways, mm-hmm. and then in other times you just sit there and think to yourself, yeah, I would probably be exactly the same as that. I believe the actual break, or when the first one went off, that it actually it's detonated between his legs.
And so, yeah, it did. You know, they showed it to us, and they showed it, and then he checked to make sure everything was still there.
Yeah, that's yeah. I imagine, like I say, I would probably have the same thought process.
Yes, of course. I mean, we'll see that in part three. That there is also another scene where I think it's Lipton checks to make sure that everything is still in place.
Yes.
You know, but it makes sense. You know, there's no reason to not want to check and double check.
No.
That type of thing. And then Garnier screams, "Jesus Christ!"
Yes,
because they're trying to figure out how to get to the next battery, and there's a German soldier shooting at them. And do you notice that we can see like the dead German soldiers on the field? You know,
yes,
it's a little gruesome the way that they show it, but again, it's adding to the realism that you know these men are dead, that they were trying to run away. One of them is probably the guy who got his face blown off by Compton's grenade that he threw.
One of his more accurate throws, yes.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
One of his quarterback throws.
That's right. And then, was it a quarterback throw, or do you think it was his catcher throw? I think it was his catcher throw.
Possibly, yeah.
Because
pick or choose, couldn't he?
That's right. I think in the book they talk about the fact that since he was an all-star catcher, you know, he needed to make the throw to second base, and you know was able to get the distance, you know, with that type of thing. That's, you know, and I would think that a grenade is probably well, I know for a fact that a grenade is closer in size to a baseball than a football. You know, from that,
it certainly is.
So it's probably a little easier for him to throw that type of thing. And then Garnier gives instructions to Lorraine. He goes, "Lorraine, through, go, anarchy." And you know, they get ready to you know, try to figure out a way of flanking the German who's shooting at them. You know, Garnier lays down cover fire as they're doing that. And then we see Lipton in the tree, finally gets out of the tree, and he screams, "Rainey, let's move. They've got the first gun."
Yes.
And then
just a quick one back there from the, what I loved about that episode that part of the scene where the German is coming up and shooting, taking cover again, and obviously when Bell starts to fire back, he'll duck down. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty risky maneuver for Bell to be up there, but what I loved is just before it, you could see him in the background, you could see the muzzle flashes and the ricochets off that first gun. And mm-hmm. or off whichever piece of equipment was. I believe it's the first gun.
Yeah, it's the first gun.
And I found that fascinating. I mean, I do agree about the German bodies there, but the only way that Bill knew to get their heads down, it's the ideal leadership move as well, is you take that fire and stand up and draw the fire in their direction, or
exactly,
or, you know, get the heads down while the others can find a better vantage point. So
yeah, I mean, we saw that even Bill. In Saving Private Ryan, where Miller jumps out in front and, you know, to draw fire. And then Mike gets angry at him, and he said, "Your mother wouldn't like that." And he goes, "I thought
your mother would be very upset."
That's right. He says,
I thought you were my mother.
Exactly. So again, you're right. It's the idea of drawing fire from that perspective. You know, one of the things they talk about in the book, which is really interesting, is that many of the men have said in retrospect, you know, had this not been their first battle, and had they been more war-torn at this point, they probably wouldn't have exposed themselves as much as they did. I mean, even Lipton climbing the tree, which I just mentioned, you know, he admitted afterwards that it was a really, really stupid thing to do, you know, but it worked for that particular time of what he needed.
And that tree in the previous episode was absolutely hammered by German fire.
Exactly.
You don't see it as much when you see him in this bit where he tells Rani to move.
That's right.
But, you know, that's a really precarious place to be shooting from.
Exactly. And then we see Lipton and Rani running through the trenches, trying to get towards where Winters is. And then Winters is looking and he sees the next gun. He goes, "There's the second gun. And then you said, yes. Grenades first. He goes, then keep going. Go. And then Compton says, right. And then he goes, okay. And they start running off towards the, in the direction of the gun by going through the trenches.
They did. Did you notice how well organized and ornate these trenches were?
Yes.
So these little culverts with viewpoints, I mean, they've even gone into the detail of having the axe marks in the posts from where they would have cut them down and then shaved those down using hatchets, which is just incredible. It is very, very detailed.
Very much. Which, again, is great. And that's why this all comes across so realistically by the way that they do this.
Absolutely. Yeah, and there goes the cook-off again.
That's right.
I did question where, I think, whose was it? Was it Joe Toy's? They threw two grenades in here.
They threw two grenades. And you heard the second one explode. One of them is Compton's, and the other one is it Joe Toy?
It is Joe Toy, yeah. So you see the first one explode, but not the second. You hear the second, and they're already in there, which to me would be crazy.
One of them they miss because you see that it hits the dirt next to them.
Ah, so it was outside to the left of the trench then.
To the right.
I see. Okay.
Right hand side.
Yeah. Okay.
As they get into the area of the battery, and they just shoot the Germans that are there, and a few of them manage to get away also. And then
yes,
one of them starts.
Yes. One prisoner.
Yeah, one of the prisoners starts speaking in German, and they don't know what he's saying. He says, and then he says in English, "No, make dead."
Yeah.
And Toy just says, shut up. And then he keeps talking in German. He goes, shut the fuck up. He goes, no make dead. So
obviously, Nick Sheeson being don't shoot. Or yes. No shooting. The other one, I think I looked up, it was no weapons, no more weapons.
Could be.
Something Waffa.
Right.
Something Waffa Mir. I can't remember. And obviously,
and then Joe hits him with his fist, which has brass knuckles on them.
It does. Chekhov's brass knuckles, I wrote in my thing, because they were... they were.
That's right.
I remember him saying on the D-Day prep.
That's right.
I could do with some brass knuckles.
That's right.
So they've mysteriously arrived.
What do you know about brass knuckles?
I'm sure you're going to tell me.
I will, but I first wanted to know what you know.
Well, they're not only made out of brass, and you can have various designs of them from very simple looking like linked up, and then you can have them with a palm strengthener, almost, so that when you punch it doesn't ram it back towards your wrist.
Right. Okay, do you know any other names for brass knuckles?
Knuckle dusters would be one.
Very good.
Not sure about any others.
Nux. Knuckle dusters and Nux.
Nux. Okay.
And they're made from either brass, steel, aluminum, sometimes even polymers. And the idea is that it fits perfectly into someone's hand and goes around the area where the knuckles are in order to cause much more damage than when you would do if you're just using your hand.
I imagine it would probably also protect your hand from damage also, wouldn't
it? Yeah, they do because the it's a more powerful hit, and therefore if you would hit with your hand that way, then it's possible you would break your fingers, from that. There are versions that have spikes on them. Some of them have knives on them.
Okay.
You can find some types that have carbon fiber in order to be lighter and less detectable by metal detectors. Obviously, you can't take brass knuckles through airports.
No. Well, you can't take much through airports anymore, to be fair.
That's true. That is very true. and The it's not easy to go and buy them. Let's put it that way.
No.
There are places you can buy them online, but there are many local laws don't allow them. I mean, again, I don't think that Joe Torre had much of a problem, going through customs, getting into Normandy to be able to make sure he has them.
No. And I imagine who was it that got the pistol from
That
the
was Talbot
Talbot? Yeah, Talbot getting a pistol through the mail.
from getting a pistol through the mail from the local sheriff. Give him hell.
Yeah, that's awesome. I wonder how the modern postal system would cope with that.
I don't know. I do not know.
So like, I love the way.
When do you think people started using brass knuckles?
Oh, well, I imagine there were probably some sort of modified implement from wartime, but way, way before this war. Oh, I don't know.
So it pretty much goes back to the American Civil War, so the
Oh, okay.
mid 1800s. That a lot of soldiers tried to buy them, and there was something to make their own. They would melt lead bullets and use a mold in the dirt in order to create them, in order to in order to have them when they were in the middle of battle.
Wow. So if it got hand to hand, that's yeah, they would come into their own, wouldn't they? I do like the little close up of Toy's hand as he takes it back and secretes them back about his person for a later use, and goes back to the Thompson.
How many U.S. states do you think it's illegal to have brass knuckles in, of the 50 states?
Of the 50. Oh, well, I mean, I'm gonna conservatively say somewhere near half of them.
And you would be right. It's 20. 20
Ooh.
out of the 50 states it's prohibited.
Wow. Okay.
And obviously there are other states that have different different laws regarding it. Some of them,
Yeah.
you have to be over 18 to own it. You have to get a permit, things like that.
A
But yeah,
brass knuckle permit. Okay.
exactly. Fun. Winters claps the toy on the back as they're doing that, and Winters then moves into the area where the gun is, as it looks like he's still being shot at there, and he shoots back,
Yes.
and then he starts giving out more instructions. Buck says, "Stay down, stay down." He goes, "Compton, all right, cover for me. We must be do something right. Look, we got them so confused they're firing on their third gun. Says, we better blow this thing before they figure out what's happening." He goes, "I'll see what's keeping Lipton. All right, Toy, cover, Lieutenant." And he goes, "I think one of those." And that, so, at this point, they've basically told us that Lipton's the one who has the way to destroy these guns.
To knock out the guns, yeah.
Yeah. And then we see Malarkey, putting in another clip and getting ready, and he screams over to the guys next to him, and he goes, "I think one of those dead Krauts has a Luger." And he goes, "So what?" And he goes, "Keep your head low, Betty. Come on, move it." And then he just gets up, and Malarkey just gets up and runs onto the field to try to get them. To try to get this Luger, and as he finally gets there, he realizes that it's not. And they scream, "Malarkey!" They go, "Now you stop firing." He goes, "Beautiful."
Beautiful.
It's
Yeah,
and
I think
he's lying there next to this dead German, who it turns out that it was just a binocular case that he had there.
oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he was not happy about that. And he goes, "Christ, they must think he's a medic or something." And then someone screaming, "He's gonna need a goddamn medic." And Malarkey decides that he's had enough, and he's gonna go back. And he goes, Okay. And he goes, "Malarkey." He goes, "Get low." "What the hell are you doing? Come on." He goes, for and then he finally gets back. He does a nice zigzag as
He
he's
does.
trying to avoid you know, the fire coming from the Germans on him.
Bit of the old serpentine.
I think one of the things that's great here is they're showing us, you know, that they're kids. You know, they're in the middle of a battle, and what's most important to him is the souvenir.
Yeah. I think, and as you said earlier, Rob, about if they had been more battle-hardened, you know, they'd have been waiting because they'd have known there'd be stuff lying around. But they would never put themselves in that situation. And you're right, they behave like kids who are after the shiny thing, you know, little magpie kids.
Exactly. And I mean, we see it later on in the miniseries also.
You know, we do.
The fact that you know, Hubler is very interested in finding a way to get a you know, to get a Luger also.
The infamous Luger, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, that obviously doesn't that doesn't end as well as this one does.
No.
You know.
No. I do love the cinematography, when the squibs were going off or whatever sort of they were using there to imitate the rounds hitting the ground. Mm-hmm. And also the sound, the sound is unbelievable. When I would imagine that would be exactly how it would feel and sound in combat in that situation. And you can't really demonstrate the rounds going past you, but you can certainly demonstrate them picking up dirt, you know, which they've gone for here, and it's just so beautifully done.
Again, they do an amazing job, basically giving us a realistic view of what happened there. You know,
very much so.
That type of thing. You know, you and I who have military backgrounds. I don't know if you've ever been in combat. I have not, but no. You know, the watching this stuff as someone who's been trained for these type of situations is always, you know, it always gets me the realism. I mean, again, we can go back to Saving Private Ryan about that whole thing also. I mean, as a trained infantryman, that scared the crap out of me. Yeah. You know, that is, you know, it's theoretically as close as you can really get to combat without being in combat. You know, that type of
thing. Absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
And this show continues with that without a problem.
Yeah, it's very visceral. It's very realistic. But I think given the pedigree of the people who brought it out and the shows and movies that came before it, you know, they had to go some to make it what it was. And, you know, I would say that it's a masterpiece, me personally. I love it.
I agree. Are you also a fan of the Pacific and Masters of the Air?
Yes. So I'm a big fan of Austin Butler at the moment. I think he's phenomenal. There's just something about him. But also the Pacific, I love the fact that people said, oh, the Pacific's not as good as Band of Brothers, you know, all that kind of stuff. And you have to sit there and say, you've got to watch those shows based on their own merits and not in a comparison to, you know, to Band of Brothers. You can't, correct. You, it's not something you should compare. It's something you should watch individually and draw your own conclusions to.
Yeah, because they also both have a completely different viewpoint, forgetting about the fact that we're dealing with different battle theaters, but they have absolutely different viewpoints and different way of them trying to tell the story. This, you know, this series is telling the story of the invasion of Europe through the eyes of you know, a company of men that lived through it. The Pacific does something completely different. It's showing us the hell of being on you know, island jumping and having to fight and things like that, and the emotional toll that it took on all of these men, both while they were there and, you know, even afterwards. You know,
very much so.
So, yeah. That's, so, and And Masters of the Air, again, it tells you a completely different story, even though they sort of get the Stalaglyph 3 stuff, not I still prefer the Grayscale.
Yeah, well, I will. Yeah, I'm my next, ironically, my next thing is I'm doing a podcast where For You the War Is Over, based on Escapes, and this was the series completely around the Great Escape, and I'll be discussing the investigation of what happened afterwards.
Oh wow. Yeah, I
So
mean, you and I have talked about that in the past, so yeah, I would love
we have
that. Yeah.
very,
Very
very
cool.
much looking forward to that too. So
Yeah, I can't wait to hear that for sure. And at this point, Malarkey finally gets back to their lines,
to
and
the loving arms of Bill Garnier.
that's right. And Bill Garnier, the first thing he says, "You forgot your friggin' Luger." He goes, "You want I should get it for you, Mick? You stupid Mick."
I love the this is military banter at its finest. You're not gonna get any sympathy. You're not gonna get a, are you okay, buddy? No, you're not gonna get that. You're just gonna get abuse. And so you should, for doing something
Exactly.
stupid.
For doing something so stupid like that, I for sure. There's absolutely no question about that. And then Winters is already there, and Winters goes, "Where's Winston with the TNT?" He goes, "I don't know, sir."
What I believe would be sulfur, maybe sulfur, or quick
Yes.
plot to pop our
Papa.
Wayne's bee hand.
That's right. And Popeye's not too happy, and he goes, and then Lipton says to him, "You'll be all right, Papa." He goes, "I'm sorry, I messed up." "Don't be sorry." He goes, "Hey, Sarge, you think this is a ticket home?" He goes, "Maybe." And I'm not even sure by the way that he asked that question if he's saying that he wants to go home or not. And
Yeah.
then he goes, "I just got here." So I guess that gives us the answer from that perspective.
I would say so, yeah.
At this point, Lipton just realizes that he's got to keep moving on. He gives Popeye a pat on the back and starts moving out to reach the battery. They finally get there, and he's there with Hall. And then Garnier says, "Hey, a cowboy." He goes, "Shut your f-ing guinea trap, gonorrhea." And then Garnier goes, "Hey, he's all right, that kid."
Yeah, return is fire indeed, eh? That was from the earlier episode, I believe, is you've just got to learn to
That's right.
return his fire.
Exactly.
And he got, I would say he put a good volley in there.
And then he screams, "Jesus, you got a whole crap platoon out there." And then he goes, "Probably more, Captain."
Yeah. The captain looks very out of place.
Yes, he really does.
Proper rabbit in the headlights, and the thing about Winters, and as everybody sees here, is Winters is very much a man of, he understands the textbooks, he understands the maneuvers and objectives, but
That's right.
he also understands good leadership means being the man at the front and also making sure that you communicate effectively. And that's pretty much all he does through this, apart from firing more than randomly at a few people and taking out Germans as he goes. He concentrates on making sure that everybody knows what everyone's doing. And in a maneuver like this, that's probably why this is still such a, well, it's still taught at West Point, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
This is a textbook, textbook assault on a gun emplacement. So.
Exactly. And then Winter. Then they say, "I need ammo, sir. Lots of it." He goes, "And TNT." And then Hall says, "I got TNT, sir." He goes, "Good job, Private." He goes, "Jesus." And he goes, "Hall, you ready?" And he starts stuffing it into the. Into the barrel of the artillery gun, and he goes, "Sir, I don't have any way to set it off, sir."
Yes.
And he's we then see some of the guys still shooting at the Germans that are going around, and Winters looks around throughout the battery trying to find something, and he finds a German grenade, and decides that that's what he's gonna do. And he interestingly already knows how to use it. You know, it's nice that they've been trained to do it. So he twists off the cap and puts it into the head of the barrel, pulls the pin, and screams, "Fire in the hole!" And then we see a cartoon like explosion, because the end of the barrel is completely mangled.
The Acme Dynamite explosion.
Exactly.
I do often wonder if that would work in that exact way.
I don't know. I'm curious if that's how they did it or not. Or maybe it's just for us to think of Wile E. Coyote. It is possible. I don't know. And then Winters continues to give instructions, and he goes, "Plesha, covering fire." And he's getting ready, and he points to the where the third gun, and he goes, "Third gun here." And he goes, "Lorraine, grab some more of those potato mashers and follow me." And then they start running through the trenches, and Winters is leading the way, and he gets up, and he keeps every so often stands up and starts shooting. And then he goes, "Malarkey, Hull, you two, go." It's done so well.
It really is. It's frantic, and it's, adrenaline. It's bound to push your adrenaline up. But the one thing I noticed is that as Dick Winters is moving around, he's using the posts as some sort of support as he runs. So he runs along, holds a post, up, fire, weapon back down, holds the next post. And almost, like he's stabilizing himself as he goes. And I don't know whether that was just put in as a way of showing that he was just trying to maintain a focus on something else, or I don't know. No,
I feel that he was just pulling himself along because he's like crouching down at the same time.
Because for me, I would have thought there would be nothing to take my hands off a weapon system if I was running through a trench like that.
Okay, but again, he's not shooting at that time, because he also knows that the trench is leading to a battery where his men are. He's not moving into a battery at this point where there's where you have the enemy there. So I don't know. So he finally reaches the battery, and we see Buck is there, and Buck is shooting, and then Buck goes, "Running a little low on ammo, sir." And he goes, "How about Malarkey?" He goes, "Okay." He goes, "Think you got enough to take that third gun? We'll find out soon, Dick. Malarkey, let's go. Toy, cover." And the three of them get ready to take off as they're
I just noticed something, that Dick Winters is the only one with his chin strap done up.
True.
Everybody else is running around with a chin strap flapping in the wind.
That's true. And then Hull runs off through the trench, and he goes, "Okay, Hull, keep your head down." And Hull then is in front of him, and he screams, "Hull, leave your TNT." And then as Hull, we get a shot of Hull running through into one of the bunkers, and then there's a huge explosion. And we see then they quickly just flip back to the second gun, and Winter screams, "Fire in the hole!" And he goes, "Malarkey, cover the front.
Yes,
go to the cannon." As they're making the assault, and we're gonna have to wait until tomorrow to figure out what exactly is happening, but. We do see that, as they reach the third battery, Buck and Malarkey are just shooting everywhere, and we see these Germans just falling on the ground.
Yes. It would be interesting to look at. I spent a long time, and I wondered this from the very first time I watched it, is how did Hull actually...
It makes it seem as if it was a booby trap.
Was it a booby trap?
They never explicitly tell us, And the book
Yeah,
doesn't
but
mention
then.
anything about Hall. Yeah, they I believe that it just mentions that there was a
No,
guy named Hall from the other
no.
company that was in the assault with them. I don't think that it mentions.
Yeah, it would be interesting because we see Winters later on going through that exact same place, and he's able to make it through there. And I imagine if.
Well, again, if it was a booby trap, so the booby trap went off.
Yeah, but then
So from that
it would have
perspective,
damaged that entire area that was inside, that part of the bunker. So I don't know, it's just.
right. The only thing it says here in the book about Hall, it has one little sentence or two sentences. It says Private John D. Hall of A Company joined the group. Winters ordered a charge on the third gun. Hall led the way and got killed, but the gun was taken. Winters had three of his men secure. With 11 men, he now controlled 3-105. That's all it says about Hall.
Okay.
In as we talked at the beginning of part two, he meets up with Hall. They take this one line and decide to create this character and a connection between Winters and this character, and then the character gets blown up and gets killed,
Yes.
and that's it. So I mean, tomorrow we'll see a little bit more about his reaction from
We
that whole thing.
will.
Yes. So is there anything else you wanted to mention about this particular 5-minute segment?
No, nothing at all. I think we've covered that
All
pretty
right.
well.
Perfect. So today's segment is Band Brand, where my guests will give their top five movie bands.
Okay.
So why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Okay, my number five is a little bit from left field. The Lone Rangers from Airheads. Steve Buscemi, Adam Sandler, and Brendan Fraser as some rockers who take over a radio station, and they called themselves the Lone Rangers. A terrible idea for a band name. A terrible idea to get your song put on the radio. But I still think it's a cult classic movie. I love it. I think it's great.
It's your list. You can have whatever you want on
Okay, number four.
it.
Barry Jive and the Uptown Five from the movie High Fidelity. Barry Jive, aka Jack Black, and I do like the fact that. When they were presenting themselves, they said we were going to call ourselves Kathleen Turner Overdrive, but we went for Barry Jive and the Uptown Five. And then they sang, he sang "Let's Get It On" by Marvin Gaye, which was really, really good. Number three, Crucial Taunt from Wayne's World. Well, it's Tia Carrere, isn't? Very little else I can say about that. Number two, Spinal Tap. I think everyone, if you're thinking fictional bands, you've got to look at Spinal Tap, especially with the new movie out. I just think they were incredible. Very, very funny. And number one, now you see, I'm a bit torn with this one because are they a fictional band? I don't think they're a fictional band. The Blues Brothers.
They're fiction. They started off
Well,
fictional,
right, well, we'll
so
take
there
it
you go.
then. Perfect.
Exactly.
Steve Cropper,
For
Donald
sure.
Duck Dull, Steve Cropper, R.I.P. as a few days ago. Donald Duck Dunn, Blue Lou, you had, and just all these great cameos, Ray Charles, James Brown, Aretha Franklin, you name it, they were all in there. And Jake and Elwood just brought them all together, and they were. They were incredible. Easily my favorite band, I think, of all movies. So there
Okay,
you go.
that makes sense. Excellent. All right. So now we will play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie.
Ooh, right.
So I will spin the wheel and we will see what random movie you get that I'll give you some clues about and you have to try and guess what it is. So around and around and around the wheel goes. and let's see where we're gonna get.
Hmm.
Okay, an Italian peasant and his wife try to find a way to keep their son safe during World War II.
Wow.
It's a movie that came out in 1997.
Italian peasant. Could I have one more clue, if possible?
Okay, the movie takes place in a concentration camp, and the father hides the son from the Germans while they're there.
Oh. Oh, my mind has gone completely blank.
And he tells his son that they are there, they're playing a game. And in order to win the game, you get points. And when you get enough points, then you get a shiny tank.
No, I'm completely lost, I'm afraid.
It won an Oscar for best foreign language film and also best actor. And upon winning the Oscar, the actor / director jumped on the stair on the chairs inside of the the Oscar pavilion where it was taken.
I honestly don't know, Rob.
And he famously said to everybody, you know, that he wants to make love to everyone in the room. Okay, the actor is Roberto Benigni. Does that help?
No. what would that have been?
Okay, so you want the answer?
Yeah, go on, man.
Okay, so the answer is Life is Beautiful.
Life is Beautiful. Not one I know, but I will have to have a look at that. Definitely.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
It's an interesting perspective. It's a pseudo comedy, which you don't normally find about movies about World War II.
A pseudo comedy. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Sounds interesting.
All right. So, yeah. So, would you like to tell everyone where they can find Paddy Flint?
Well,
international man of mystery.
I am not doing much at the moment, but what I will be doing next, as I said earlier, is I'll be appearing on a podcast called For You, the War is Over. The current series that's being recorded is about the Great Escape, which, as Rob knows, was my chosen field of expertise, being ex-military police and having a relative in the Great Escape. And I will be discussing the Great Escape investigation after the end of the war and the ramifications of that at that time. So that's For You, the War is Over. The episodes that are out there now are phenomenal. They go into each and every escaper and talk about what happened to them, about their life, and about where they ended up. So I'll be doing that. Wow.
Very good. Excellent. All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@moviearound.net. So, until tomorrow, hurry!
Hooray!